Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
All right, hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Brantley Palmer. Today, I'm joined by Lee Carlo and also Jeremy Fisk, who's gracing us with his presence after missing last week. Today, we're going to talk about the new independent film in theaters, Hesher, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Rainn Wilson, and Natalie Portman. After that, we're going to go on into a tie-in segment with independent films and what makes them work, what doesn't make them work, and then we're going to transition into Jeremy's review of Yee Yee, playing off what Lee and I discussed last week in our Just Effing Watch It segment, and then we're going to wrap everything up with our top five movie punks.
My name is Paul Forney, and this is my son TJ. I lost my wife, TJ's mom, a bit more than 2 months ago.
Is your dad up yet?
Has he been sleeping all day?
You know, sometimes people get thrown off balance when bad things happen, but they come good again in the end.
Hello there, young man.
Hey, old lady.
TJ, who is this?
My name's Hesher. I'm a friend of your son's.
Oh!
Okay. Where are you going? I'll give you a ride.
Don't talk to me, okay?
Sorry about the other night. I was totally out of control and foolish and irresponsible. So, sorry. Yeah, I think I can be some help here. She was just sitting there and you backed right into it.
I what? Sometimes, you know, a day is bad and you think it couldn't get any worse. And then suddenly you discover whole new ways it can get worse.
Dude, you're not shopping. You're stalking that chick.
No, I'm not.
You seem a little older than TJ.
I used to have this snake. I used to have to feed him and give him a live mouse. And there was this one time, the mouse got up on his hind legs and punched him in the face.
So this week, we made an effort to go out and check out Spencer Susser's film, Hesher, starring one of Get Your Film Fix favorites, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. This is an indie film, and I think throughout this podcast, we're going to say the word indie a lot, and we'll sort of clarify what we mean by that in a little bit. But it's in the sort of vein of a, Garden State, it's kind of a funny story type movie, where we get this character that I think, for all intents and purposes, Spencer Susser wants to be sort of an iconic, rebellious character played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt called Hesher. Now, did you guys walk away from this movie saying, yeah, we introduced into the popular culture a new badass character? Or did you walk away from this movie feeling a little empty towards him?
I know for me personally, I felt kind of empty towards him because I just feel like his character was just very much like this F society type of guy, but that never had to have any type of consequences whatsoever. So I feel in many ways like the film is like this, it's a teenage boy's like fantasy, you know, being able to say, you know, F society, F the establishment, and then there's no consequences that come from it, you know?
Right, so, for no apparent reason.
Yeah, and for no reason either. I mean, obviously, you know, TJ and his dad, Paul Forney, played by Rainn Wilson, they obviously have issues that they're dealing with, but the whole relationship between Hesher and the boy, I felt, was just completely forced. And, you know, obviously his character is like the id to TJ, you know, like his anger and rage that's boiling over. But it's just, I definitely came away hollow from the character, even though I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt played him well, and I think that at times he is funny. By the end of the movie, I was just so done with him that I definitely feel empty towards him.
Yeah, I mean, just in response to, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt played him well, and at times he was funny, but it was kind of like, so what? Like, who is this character? Is kind of what I was thinking the whole time. And And there's just nothing there to develop him or anybody, really. There's some, you know, glimpses at maybe some character development here, but there was nothing about any of these characters that left a lasting impression.
Well, I think we sort of I'm getting the sense we're all going to sort of agree on this movie, which is good, because I walked out of this movie thinking I was literally crazy. I'm like, because I had heard decent reviews, and it's got a 7.4 on IMDb, and I walked out of this movie going, you know what, maybe it's one of those movies that's happened before where I walk out of a movie and everyone feels the opposite of me. So I kind of really quickly just looked up some basic reviews, and I don't usually do it, especially if we're going to do a podcast on it, but I looked up some basic reviews to see if I was crazy, and I found Mick LaSalle's review from the San Francisco Chronicle. Let me just basically quote him, because he says it better than I ever could. Hesher is about as awful as an independent film gets, a mix of ugliness and unearned sentiment with a flat story. Repellent and pathetic characters and dialogue that consists of lots of stammering and cursing. Could not have said it better. This movie does not earn anything it tries to go for, whether it be the writing, the characters, the relationships. I literally wrote down when I was watching it, I felt like I was dropped on another planet. I didn't know who these people were. I didn't understand how they interacted with each other or what their motivation for anything was. I mean, it was as alien a movie to me as, let's just say, Aliens or something. I mean, I haven't disliked characters this much since Hobo with a Shotgun, but at least with Hobo with a Shotgun, they tried to make characters that I shouldn't like.
All the way back when we saw Hobo with a Shotgun.
But I compare it to that because I can't think of another movie where I came out of it just being like, oh, I hate these people. But Hesher, it's not one of those movies that I should be coming out of it saying I hate every single one of these people.
Well, since you brought up these characters being so unlikable, I'll bring up the fact that I think that these actors tried to bring some redeeming qualities into this movie. Particularly if you look at the grandmother, who's played by Piper Laurie, and Hesher's relationship with her, and Natalie Portman's character in general. And just quick side note, Natalie Portman was terribly miscast in this movie.
What do you mean? She wore glasses and she had a ponytail.
She looked frumpy.
I mean,
that's,
I think,
like Oscar.
Maybe Natalie Portman 5 years ago, this is the right role for her, you know, around her Garden State era. But I'm sorry, you know, Oscar winner Natalie Portman was out of place in this movie.
Everyone was.
I mean,
JGL.
I mean, that's true. But
even though this was sort of a vehicle for JGL to play against type, and I think that's why he took it. But other than that, really, there's, like I said, this movie earned nothing that it tried to do.
And again, another side note, if I have to read one more good review where it talks about how great it is seeing JGL playing the opposite of his character in 500 Days of Summer, I'm going to puke.
Right, because what's the point of playing the opposite of your character
in 500
Days in Summer if you're playing somebody that has no sort of redeeming value or qualities to them that make them worth watching?
But anyway, to those redeeming qualities that I think maybe some of the actors tried to bring to it, the script was so void of any of it, and I got the impression that the director, Spencer Susser, was so intent on giving his audience, and by extension the world, the middle finger, that he didn't care to give any redeeming qualities to his movie.
Yeah, I think that literally Spencer Susser's, like I said in my intro, goal, and I don't know this, I'm just speculating, goal for this movie was to introduce sort of an iconic badass character, an FU character, to cinema history, which he fails in doing because this character has nothing that you want to sort of get behind.
I agree with kind of all we're saying here, and I agree with the article. I don't think I would be as strongly against the film because I didn't hate it. It was just a big disappointment. But I think part of that reason is that I don't dislike the character. I just think that there's no reason for them to be there. Like, there's no reason for Natalie Portman to be in this movie whatsoever. There's no reason really for Hesher to be in the movie. I feel like there could have been a story between Rainn Wilson and the TJ character and the grandma there dealing with the loss of the wife and mother. But ultimately, I think, you know, they're just unnecessary, and that's kind of the point. The whole movie is just kind of very unnecessary in that sense.
That's actually a good point, because if you just look at these as characters or caricatures, whatever you want to call them, yeah, maybe there's something interesting about them, but there's I apparently used the word forced earlier, and that's the perfect way to say it. Like, why are we supposed to believe that Rainn Wilson is allowing Hesher to just squat in his garage? Like,
oh yeah,
just because he's grieving and, like, I guess spineless, I think we're supposed to believe. This, I mean, there's no motivation for any of the actions in this movie. And yeah, that's what Susso was trying to do with the character of Hesher, an unmotivated, like, you know, outcast who just hates the world. But, you know, there needs to be a story that drives his actions forward, or at least that his actions influence.
And I totally agree with you. There's no sort of story or structure to this movie. And like you say, I mean, basically, he just shows up at these people's house and then starts watching their TV, turning porn channels on, eating their food, and they don't call the cops. I mean, exactly. It makes no sense to me. I mean, you can be spineless, but you can also pick up the phone and call 911. And there's just stuff. There's stuff like that throughout the whole movie that just absolutely makes no sense. That there's no motivation. I think we keep saying the word motivation. There's no motivation for a lot of this. And I keep going back to this. This movie didn't earn the right to have those moments, to have the moment of Hesher just coming in and squatting with these people and being this sort of badass. I mean, it doesn't earn it. We don't understand why. So what's the point?
Yeah, I think the movie kind of it wants to have its cake and eat it too. It wants to have the character of Hesher, who, you know, flips the middle finger to everybody and can blow up cars with no consequences and just throw a bunch of stuff in some random person's pool. But then it also will have scenes in which Rainn Wilson is preaching responsibility to his son at the dinner table. I mean, it's really kind of ridiculous in that sense.
Yeah, and stemming off that, because this is something I really want to talk about, and, you know, kind of the morals that we're supposed to take out of this with responsibility and, you know, coping with grief and getting on with life and, you know, dealing with all that. I haven't seen anything about this comparison. I just made this comparison myself, and not that anybody should be comparing this movie to Nora Ephron's Michael, but I did get that Susser was trying to make this guardian angel type character out of Hesher as well.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, it's this badass guardian angel smoking cigarettes, cursing all the time, and watching porn, but he's actually there to help this family cope with their loss. And, you know, I only get that because he kind of highlights what the grandmother was trying to do, which is a good thing he did that, because nothing else was highlighting it, because she was just so kind of aloof the whole time. And I think that if Susser is going to try to create a character that gives the world the middle finger, he can't also try to make a movie about a badass guardian angel.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you call him a guardian angel, because I certainly think that was the case. But I literally didn't know if Hesher was real until Rainn Wilson's character also saw him. I thought he was a manifestation of TJ's consciousness, because he just kept showing up. Like, when TJ broke that window, and then Hesher was in there, and then right away some security guard came out, and then he tried to blow the security guard up. And then when he's in class, he's outside the window, and he looks back over there, and then Hesher's gone. And he kept sort of appearing at the end of the hall, and then he just all of a sudden appeared in his living room. And I was like, okay, maybe this guy's not real. And then Rainn Wilson saw him, and I was like, this makes no sense.
You know what? I wouldn't have minded that movie you just described.
I would have liked it more than this movie.
And it's funny that you brought up that you kind of got that impression, because there was a point in the movie when I was speculating how this story was going to shape, and it was when they were flashing back to them driving, and we all knew what was going to happen. We knew it was going to be the car accident.
Yeah.
And I thought it was going to be Hesher that crashed into them, and that he, ooh, you know, drove off, and he was overcome with guilt, and that's kind of what led him to be the outcast that he is. And, you know, that's where I thought it was going, but, you know,
at least that would have had motivation.
Yeah, God forbid. Yeah.
But, and there's definitely symbolism to the idea of him being an angel. I mean, you literally get the shot of the clouds in the shape of angel wings, like right before he shows up at the funeral and kind of crashes it. So he was definitely supposed to be considered like a guardian angel type figure in the movie.
But it was it's terrible because they didn't do that until the end. Like there was nothing about what he was doing that was helping any of these characters until
end
with his speech at the funeral home that kind of like allows Rainn Wilson and TJ to come to a realization. But until then, he was a negative influence on everybody he was around.
Oh, well, absolutely.
Let's talk about that ending. I mean, you say it helped them come to some realization. Maybe, probably a little bit. But was that realization
Rainn Wilson shaved. Obviously, he came to a realization.
Yeah. Was that realization warranted within... Like, I mean, but first of all, let's talk about how cheesy, absolutely cheesy scene was where they take the coffin and start walking down the road in slow motion and there's these close-ups of them all, like, crying and Rainn Wilson just looks ridiculous.
Yeah, and talk about – sorry to interrupt you, but talk about an actor who, like, I thought going – like, the first half of this movie maybe was kind of getting away from his Dwight self and then just totally bottomed out and was terrible.
I don't blame him. I think all that stuff was the direction given. The director's like, I want you to be as emotional as possible. I want to see tears come down your face. We're going to do this in slow motion, and we're going to have this great sort of quirky indie image of a coffin and three guys walking down the street. This is going to be brilliant.
It's going to be a great trailer shot.
I mean, it wasn't, again, like everything else in this movie, it wasn't warranted. It didn't make any sense.
I mean, it was just another example of the forced... It was like forced sentimentality at the end that the film, you know, I mean...
The film doesn't earn.
Exactly. Yeah. I was just going to say, Jeremy's been talking about how this film doesn't earn anything, and it definitely doesn't earn that sentimentality at the end.
No, like, are we supposed to feel bad for these people now all of a sudden? I don't know who these people are. I don't know what planet they're from. I don't understand how they interact with each other. Why all of a sudden, when they decide to care about something, should we as an audience care about it?
I mean, my first three notes, and just, you know, we've said it over and over again, but I think this just kind of encapsulates how we all feel about this movie. My first three notes are three questions. What is this movie about? Who are these characters? Why do we care about them? Right. And I mean, when you don't have an answer to those questions, you don't have a good movie.
I literally hated this movie, and I love JGL, but I really hated this movie. Like the reviewer said, this is the worst type of indie movie, and I think... Well, we're going to talk about what makes a good indie movie and what makes a bad indie movie. But just because you have weird characters and can play some slow motion and some music does not mean you have a good indie quirky movie.
I think that, you know, Levitt gives a good performance. I think Rainn Wilson actually does give a good performance, but I think, especially towards the end of the film, with all that ridiculous sentimentality that's thrown into it, like it just goes for naught, basically. And I think Piper Laurie gives a good performance. Ultimately, I think those are all wasted because it's such a disappointing movie.
I think it's very interesting that we were talking about all these people and talking about all these performances, but we don't talk about TJ, played by Devin Brochu, who is the little kid. And of course, finding a good kid actor is really tough. But he was bad. I don't know what else to say.
I don't think so. I think he was solid. The kid actor I had a problem with was the bully who was constantly picking on him. He was bad. TJ, I think, was solid throughout. Not great, but solid.
I agree, Brantley. I think I didn't have a problem with Devin Brochu. But that bully, I mean, and that that character in every movie is a terrible actor. For whatever reason, they can't find a good actor to play the bully.
Whatever, man. It's fine. I don't need this crap, really. There's, you know... I'm comfortable. I'm unhassled. People don't realize this, but loneliness, it's underrated.
You can just ask her out.
Don't be stupid.
We've been talking a little bit about indie movies with Hesher, and I think stemming off of that, we could kind of discuss. I mean, I think it's really easy to pick out, especially with a movie like Hesher, things that work in indie movies as opposed to things that don't work. And when we say indie, we're talking about movies like Hesher, which is kind of like a fad type indie movie now with the quirky characters and at least for me, it's the statements that they're always seem to be trying to make.
Right. I think, it's hard to define what we're talking about here because indie movies can, you know, range obviously from, you know, exterior films, The Gray Area, to Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. I mean, but we're sort of talking about these movies like Hesher, like you said, that have that, I guess, for lack of a better word, that quirk factor, those out there characters in this world that are trying to overcome, you know, some sort of unique obstacles, I think. I mean, that's the best I can define it. But yeah, like the Little Miss Sunshines of the world. So yeah, let's talk about what for we didn't we all seem to dislike Hesher. So why? What makes a bad indie movie? What doesn't work with these things?
I think it's when you're trying to, and especially with Hesher is the perfect example, when a director cares more about the statement he's making than the movie he's making. Mm-hmm. And here he's, and I mean, we talked about maybe how he was trying to create an iconic character, and that may be true as well. But for me, like I said, I think Spencer Susser was trying so hard to give the world the middle finger that he forgot that he had to surround it with something. And I think that, you know, people consider what they have a good idea, and they get the means to make a movie. And the means to get
Natalie Portman and
right, exactly.
Gordon-Levitt.
And they try to showcase that statement as opposed to making a good movie through which a statement can be revealed.
Right. I was really trying to think on this as far as like what works and what doesn't work in these sort of movies. And there are some movies some of these quirky indie movies I don't love, but I think they really work as movies. For example, Juno. I don't love Juno, but I would rather sit through 40 screenings of Juno than sit through one more of Hesher. And I have a quick little list of bad indie movies, and I don't see a lot of these movies, so it's really sort of a short list. The Whackness. It's kind of a funny story, which we reviewed here on this podcast, and Away We Go. And there's two things I wrote down that sort of make or break these indie movies. The first one is finding the truth. There's got to be some sort of grain of truth within this story, within the world that you create, that works. Hesher never finds that truth. Away We Go especially never finds that truth. And the other thing I wrote is quirk for quirk's sake doesn't work. It needs to serve the story. And a movie like Away We Go, where we just get introduced to one quirky character after another quirky character for the sake of it, doesn't work. Here, Hesher, the character Hesher, doesn't work because he's not serving the story. He's just there for himself. What do you guys think about that?
I definitely agree, especially in terms of Hesher. I think the problem was, you know, what we talked about, that they're creating a character just to create the character, and he doesn't actually serve the story. And in many ways, he just, you know, is destructive to the other characters in the movie. And yet we're still supposed to buy into what he's selling. And that was definitely the biggest issue I had with this movie, and the biggest problem that didn't make it work. I wasn't as down on Away We Go or It's Kind of a Funny Story as you are, Jeremy. Those were kind of more middle-of-the-road type of indies for me, and I can't speak to The Whackness because I haven't seen it. But I think that's kind of the big problem is what you mentioned, the quirk for quirk's sake. When you're trying to give your film some type of, you know, that thing,
Make it unique, you know,
to make it unique just so that it can get some type of maybe like recognition, and you know, but if it's not actually serving what the story of the film is, then it's completely unnecessary and not needed whatsoever.
Well, I think, and you talk about the problems with these movies is that they don't, you know, they don't get to the truth of their story. And I think part of the problem is in it, I think, either whether it's the writers or the directors, they work backwards and they create something. For example, Hesher, or I would even fault Juno for this, and especially Away We Go, since you brought those movies up. They create bits and pieces of their movie that they have to have in there and then try to work a story around it. Now, it's okay to have an idea for a character and build a story around it, but then that you actually have to do that. You can't just rely on that character. So you take Juno, for example, this kind of quick-witted high schooler who gets pregnant. Yeah, that's ripe for a story to be built around it, and I would say Juno, better than a lot of other indies, does that. But it still kind of over-highlights, if that's a word, this character of Juno, which eventually just gets on your nerves, and that's just my opinion. But Away We Go is another example, because you have all these different quirky characters that Maya Rudolph and John Krasinski go to visit in that film, And it's almost like they put a list together of quirks that all these characters could have and then said, okay, how can we get all of this into one movie? And then they said, all right, let's get people traveling from place to place. Okay, why are they traveling? And it's almost, and if you see what I'm saying, they're kind of working backwards as opposed to building a story and then putting the appropriate characters into that story.
It's interesting that JGL's in this movie because he's on the other end of the spectrum for a couple movies. One I love and one I enjoy that I think fall into this list of quirky indie films. 500 Days of Summer, which Lee, you brought up, he's sort of the antithesis of that in Hesher. 500 Days of Summer, it works. I mean, you know, you've got your manic pixie dream girl in Summer in that movie. But despite that, I mean, the movie finds its own truth. And the other one that is a little different, but certainly quirky in its writing, is Brick, which is a film I absolutely love. It's grown on me over the years, but it also stars JGL. In that movie also, I mean, it's consistent. It finds the truth. It has a great, intriguing story. I mean, that works for that movie. And it's sort of disappointing that JGL went on sort of the other side of this indie quirk debate.
I think, and I'm glad you brought up Brick, because I think that kind of speaks well to this theory that I have, because that's definitely a movie that, without a structured story or even a cohesive story, would never, ever work with the way that they talk in that movie. Had Rian Johnson gone the opposite direction there and said, I'm going to have a bunch of high schoolers talk in film noir style, and then I'll see what I can do with it, it just wouldn't have worked. But I think he did it the appropriate way and built himself a story, an intriguing one and everything, and then was able to input this quirk, for lack of a better term.
Well, if you look at Brick, I mean, it's a filmmaker's movie. I mean, he's making a film first and foremost. He's engaging the audience, and part of it, of course, is the dialogue. I mean, it's super engaging and super interesting whether or not you buy into whether high schoolers will ever talk like that. That's beside the point. He's making a film first, and the way he selects his shots and the way he builds suspense in that movie, it's really well done. I mean, and it goes to your point, Lee. I mean, he's like you said, it's not just about the dialogue in that movie. It's about building a movie first.
Yeah, I'd take it even a step further. I'd say he's not just making a film. He's telling a story first and foremost, rather than making a film first and foremost. And I think that's the key, is there's the story behind Brick, and that's what makes it work so well. And, you know, I think about other independent films that work really well, like The Station Agent with Peter Dinklage. That's just a small... you know,
no
story.
Pun
well, no, no pun intended, obviously. I'm going to say it's just like a small film, small in scope, focusing on just, you know, the story of this character as he takes over the little station there that's for the trains. Wow, that came out really stupid.
The little station there for the train.
You keep using the word little.
Little, small.
The problem is that I keep thinking about it, which makes me even more flustered because I don't want it to come across like that.
All right.
You sort of minimize it.
Anyway, but it's a story that's going on. You know, they're telling a story in that film first and foremost. And so I think that's what really separates these two different types of independent films that we're talking about, the ones that work and the ones that don't, is that there's a story and a good story behind the ones that do work. And there's often not enough story and too much quirk in the ones that don't.
What are the director's intentions is really what you have to ask, you know?
That's what I was going to say. Do we have any sort of advice for directors looking to make a indie film like that? And I guess, Lee, saying your intentions is everything.
We've always been, you know, preachers of story first, or at least I have. I mean, I feel like without it, I mean, it doesn't matter what you do. The best you can maybe get is some sketch comedy with just a interesting character. Like, there needs to be something surrounding it if anybody's going to watch it and enjoy it.
All right. Well, Jeremy couldn't join us last week on our podcast where we talked about Bridesmaids, but where we also did our Just Effing Watch It segment. Lee and I discussed the movie in that podcast, but here now to give us his opinion on the film and to tell Lee or I which one of us was right or wrong, Jeremy, take it away.
Yeah, I don't think I'm so much going to give my opinion on the film as to sort of go over you guys' critique of the film. First of all, that kind of sucks for you guys. You guys didn't get the Criterion print of the DVD?
No, I grabbed
Netflix,
no.
I
grabbed a copy from the library, and it was like an older DVD version, not the Criterion.
Man, because this movie is purposely sort of bland aesthetically, as is, so I can't even imagine having the non-Criterion print. You guys talked about it feeling like a video, and I got that sense, and I didn't have... I could definitely tell it wasn't shot, you know, on video or, you know... It looked like film from the Criterion print, so 3 hours of that. So, Brantley, you talk about sort of the performances in this movie and how you say you don't really like a lot of them. And, I didn't have huge problems with them, but I had huge problems with sort of the scale at which they were presented to us. There was, all of a sudden, it would be calm, 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 and then there would be these sort of screaming, over-the-top performances. And, I don't know, do you guys agree with that? Because there's like the very beginning when they're screaming at the wedding, and then there's the point where what was her name, Ying Ying's boyfriend at the end screams, and then there's the girl that the main character, the 30-year relationship, that all of a sudden they'll be calm, 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 and then just screaming and like at the almost suicidal. It was a weird sort of seesaw action that came from a lot of these performances, which obviously was done on purpose, but it took me out of the movie sometimes because I was like, geez, calm down.
Yeah. I definitely see what you're saying when you're bringing it up. I hadn't really thought of it then. I mean, I definitely, at the beginning of the film, had a problem with the performances, especially the girl coming into the wedding and, like, talking to the grandma and the hysterics. That I just thought was terrible. I just thought it was really, really bad. But now that you're mentioning this other stuff, I do kind of see what you're saying, that there's kind of a bit of a seesaw mentality within the performances.
Because this movie's so sort of introspective and meditative, as you guys say, and it's very slow moving. It's just interesting to me that all of a sudden there'd be these spikes in emotional level, which maybe was part of it just to keep people interested, to throw those sort of, because there's no real, like you guys said, there's no real huge moments in this movie that are sort of these catalysts for turning points of these characters. The characters, like I said, are very introspective and they're dealing with their own things, and I think these sort of emotional outbursts are there to keep reminding these people of the sincerity in which these characters feel what they're feeling, whether or not you understand it completely. The director needed a way to sort of say, hey, what they're going through is real. Because like you say Lee, in when you talk about it in your review, you say that what's the director's name, Yang?
Edward Yang.
Yeah, Edward Yang. He lets a lot play out within the frame, which this guy is not afraid of wide shots. And he's not afraid of letting things play out within the frame. So you sort of have to, as an audience, really get to a point of understanding what these characters are going through internally, which is really hard to do. And I think that's going to be the biggest reason people have trouble getting through this movie. And it was definitely a point of concern for me because it was a tough nearly 3 hours to sit through this movie. Not until maybe the last hour I started really connecting and understanding what these characters were trying to do, what questions they were asking themselves about life and relationships. And that's essentially what this movie is. It's about life and relationships. And he lets it play out like that.
Well, I mean, I agree with both of you in this sense. I think that, you know, there wasn't enough of Yang Yang. There wasn't enough of Ting Ting. You got those scenes with NJ, who's our main character. You see flashbacks. You see what his relationship with this other woman was, and you learn a lot about him. And granted, me and Brantley talked about it. It probably meant another 3 hours if we were going to get that into all of these other characters. But for this movie to be as good as I think a lot of people have said it is, that's what it needed as far as I'm concerned. You needed more from these characters because there was enough there for me to be interested in them, but there wasn't enough for all of them for it to really become like a great, you know, ensemble piece about so many different characters. Like it was good because I was interested in the characters, and I cared about a lot of them, but you really needed the same kind of depth that you got from NJ on all of them to really, you know, get the success that this movie is apparently having.
Yeah, and let's talk about how this movie sort of looked and was directed. Like, I feel like if they made an American remake, it would be a Sofia Coppola movie. Yeah. Because it's got that sort of calming, you know, feel. But at least with Sofia Coppola, she does stuff that is a little more interesting with her camera. And she creates a tone and she creates a mood. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, even though she does a lot of the same sort of introspective filmmaking where we see a lot of characters just sitting and thinking and reminiscing on their lives, which happens a lot in Yi Yi, but Edward Yang has a tough – I don't know. It's not my favorite type of filmmaking when you just sort of put the camera there. If you're going to do that, you need to really sort of be able to build characters and story a little bit better. And I go back to a movie called Tokyo Story, which does this, but it does it all, you know. For me, it's for my money, it's probably one of the best movies that sort of does the sort of still camera, very few cuts, lets things play out in the frame. So, if people are interested in seeing Yi Yi, obviously they already saw it for Just Effing Watch It. And if they liked it, I would say definitely check out Tokyo Story. I think it's much better done film.
Hey, you, get your damn hands off.
Oh, I think you got the wrong car, McFly.
George, help me, please.
Just turn around, McFly, and walk away. Are you deaf, McFly? Close the door and beat it.
No, Biff. You leave her alone.
McFly, you're asking for it, and now you're going to get it.
All right, so we're doing our top five today. Top five punks in films. Not necessarily relating to punk music, I think, but more or less relating to just characters that just don't really give a damn. I mean, that's at least how I was looking at it, but... I'm going to throw it on over to Jeremy to have him give us his criteria and his number five.
All right. So, yeah, basically with my criteria, I was just looking for people that are not just annoying, but they're out to harm other people, but aren't necessarily at the point where we would call them evil. You know what I mean? They're not going to kill anybody. They're just those punks that just really annoy you, and they're destructive for destructive sake, sort of like Hesher. All right, so my number five. This one I picked solely because I know you guys aren't going to probably have it on your list, or I'd be surprised if you do. But he was a punk. And the character's name is Sharrell Berry, and he's played by Anthony Mackie in Million Dollar Baby.
Come on, don't take the gloves off, man. You ain't even used them, Danger.
Matter of fact, borrow this, Danger.
Oh, man. I thought your name was Danger. Come on now. Oh, I see. Now I get to fight a retard and an old man. Call ESPN because you can't write this shit.
Oh! He provides probably the most clap-worthy moment of that year, as far as if you're sitting in a theater and you're watching Morgan Freeman half-blind fight him. Because he's always picking on Jay Baruchel's character, who is, I think, mentally retarded or close to it. And I know, Lee, you used to think Jay Baruchel was actually mentally retarded because of that character and the character he plays in Almost Famous.
Yep.
Yeah, which is funny. But yeah, so great he's always actor. Picking on him, and then Morgan Freeman finally steps in. But he's a punk. That's what I define as a punk. I mean, he's not going to seriously harm him, but he's going to annoy him and annoy the audience.
Yeah, I really like that pick. I kind of went with the same criteria. For me, like, I kind of blurred the line between punk and bully.
Bully is a good word, yeah.
Because, you know, it's just kind of somebody who's a jerk for no reason. Or even if he has a reason, he's just the jerk of the movie. So my number five is Mark Metcalf as Doug Niedermeyer in Animal House.
I don't remember enough to be able to say, like,
we'll throw a clip in there.
Yeah.
He's one of the pledges at the Alpha House with Greg Marmalard, who are basically, like, you know, the real prissy guys who are all upper class and wear suits and whatnot, which is basically the antithesis of the Delta House. And he's also the head of the ROTC, and he's riding around on his horse. And basically, he's just kind of a punk, especially to Tim Matheson's character, Eric Stratton, and when they beat him up at the end.
Yeah, my number five, it's probably the most obvious choice on my list. Well, one of. But I kind of had a hard time leaving it off. And that's Steve-O, played by Matthew Lillard in SLC Punk. That actually does involve punk music, but also, I mean, him and Heroin Bob are just two guys that just don't really give a damn about society and just kind of want to live their punk lifestyle.
That's your most obvious pick?
Probably.
I didn't even know who you're talking about.
You guys haven't seen SLC Punk?
No. I'm not surprised that Matthew Lillard plays a punk in a movie, though.
No, it's actually really good. It's probably his best performance in a film ever.
Better than Scream? What?
I know, right? But no, it's actually a really good movie. That you should check out. Actually, I haven't seen it in forever. I should revisit it. I know it's on Netflix instant.
All right, there you go. All right, my number four is a character that I think I kind of liked initially, but looking back on him, I really hate him, and he's a punk, and that is Steve Stifler, played by Sean William Scott in any American Pie movie, I guess.
Another good pick.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Just an annoying punk guy.
All right, my number four. Now, this is something more along the lines of an obvious pick, at least the way I look at it. And it is a character played by Zach Ward. It is Scott Fargus in A Christmas Story.
Yeah, that may come up on our list again.
Again, perhaps blurring the line between bully and punk, but, I mean, it's a thin line, so.
All right, my number four is Kim Fowley, played by Michael Shannon in The Runaways. I don't know if either of you guys have seen that movie.
I haven't caught up with it, no.
Okay.
The Kristen Stewart movie, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's decent. It's kind of standard.
Dakota Fanning.
Yeah, it's kind of standard biopic fare, but Michael Shannon actually gives a really good performance as Kim Fowley, who kind of manages their band there when they're together. And he kind of just uses them throughout, and that's kind of what made him a punk in my mind, and then kind of just discards them at the end, sort of. So that's why he's elevated to punk status in my list.
All right. My number three is one that may be on you guys' list. It may not. But it is Iceman, played by Val Kilmer in Top Gun.
Yeah, another good one. I like your list better than mine, Jeremy.
It's a good call. Yeah.
Whenever you're annoying to our main likable characters and you do a thing with your teeth where you bite, you're a punk.
All right, my number three, this is, I think, easily my most obvious pick, Thomas Wilson. It's Biff in Back to the Future.
Yeah, I was going back and forth waiting for one of you to say Biff so I could call this my Biff Memorial List.
Okay.
Because I didn't want to include him.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good call. My number three is my next most obvious pick, and I don't know if it's going to appear on your guys', but it's Alex DeLarge, played by Malcolm McDowell in A Clockwork Orange.
Oh, interesting.
I mean
for me, he's over-punked to evil.
Yeah,
that's why I didn't include him, because he's
but also
responsible for raping and I don't know murder and all that sort of stuff.
But at the same time, he kind of embodies that screw society mentality, which is, I guess, is what I was thinking coming off of Catcher, you know?
No, it works. It definitely works. What number are we on?
Number two.
Jeez. Well, all right. So that's good. I don't have to say Biff. So I can say, which is probably going to – my guess is this might be Lee's number one. And it is Johnny Lawrence played by William Zabka in The Karate Kid.
I feel like we could have gone all 80s movie villains in this movie. And Back to the Future.
Yeah, that's a good point. But, I mean, he just defines punk, even though he has that moment at the end of the movie.
You're all right, LaRusso.
So.
All right. It's funny Brantley brings up the 80s, because with the exception of my number five, Animal House, all my other movies are 80s movies. But my number two is Johnny Lawrence of the Cobra Kai, played by William Zabka. I mean, yeah, come on. He's such a punk. He, like, everything he does with the bandana around his head, like, just the fact that he's got a four-wheeler and he wheels onto the beach to steal his soccer ball.
what a punk.
He's just, he's such a punk.
We just sound like a bunch of old men. Ah, what a punk.
That's punk, kids.
All right, my number two is Otto, played by Emilio Estevez in Repo Man, and it's funny because he's actually the protagonist of the movie, but again, you know, the movie itself is just very punk in its whole mentality, so that's why it shows up on mine. It's a cult classic if you guys haven't seen it yet.
Embarrassed to say, I actually have not seen it, and I've heard a lot of good things.
Yeah.
All right. On to number ones, I guess. And my number one has already been mentioned, so I'll just say it right now. Scott Fargus, played by Zach Ward in A Christmas Story. To me, he is the ultimate punk.
Scott Fargus. What a rotten name. We were trapped. There he stood, between us and the alley. Scott Fargus staring out at us with his yellow eyes. He had yellow eyes, so help me, God, yellow eyes.
He's just waiting behind fences for kids to get... I don't know if he goes to school at any point, but he just waits for them to get out of school so that he can... you know, bend their arms behind their back and make them say uncle.
And you get his little sidekick there, too, which just adds to it. My number one, I was worried that this was going to kind of be a list full of repeats, which it hasn't to this point. So I'm one away. If this is, you know, by any chance it's Brantley's number one as well, then so be it. But my number one is Judd Nelson as Bender in The Breakfast Club.
Here's my impression of life at Big Bri's house. Son? Yeah, Dad? How's your day, pal? Great, Dad. How's yours? Super. Say, son, how'd you like to go fishing this weekend? Great, Dad. But I've got homework to do. That's all right, son. You can do it on the boat. Gee. Dear. Isn't our son swell? Yes, dear. Isn't life swell? Oh.
And Bender, I guess, is different kind of from the other punks that we've looked at as bullies, where this is more of just like the punk personality that
that's a good
that
pick.
He has.
All right, my number one, it could probably be any character from this movie just because the movie's about a bunch of roving gangs in New York fighting for territory, so literally all of them are kind of punks in a way. But it's going to be Ajax, played by James Remar from The Warriors. If you guys know, James Remar as Dexter's dad on Dexter.
Okay.
But before that, way back in the day, he was a badass member of a gang called the Warriors in the movie The Warriors.
Interesting. When you started talking about gangs in New York, I thought you were going to say Daniel Day-Lewis.
I'm like, no.
That's a villain.
No, and again, he's one of the protagonists as well. But, you know, like I said, it literally anyone in that movie could have been put on this list because they're all on the fringes of society as they're all parts of roving gangs. So,
all right.
There we have it. I have a couple honorable mentions I want to say. I really wish I could have got this in. And it is Arnie Grape, played by Leonardo DiCaprio in What's Eating Gilbert Grape. He's just, by the end of that movie, I just want to punch him. I know he's retarded, but still, I guess... It's annoying.
I don't remember that movie well enough. When you said that, I was like, what's the matter with you? He's a little retarded boy.
Trust me, it's annoying.
But that's the thing. Like, I don't know. I don't know if I classify him as a punk, though. You know?
Yeah, that's why he didn't make my list.
Yeah.
The other one I wanted to add, but he's too evil, was Carter Burke, played by Paul Reiser in Aliens.
Okay.
He's just annoying in that punk way, but his annoyingness gets people killed, so I couldn't put him on my list.
My only honorable mention just didn't make it because I don't feel like the movie is good enough, but it made the honorable mentions because it's several characters, all members of the O'Doyle family in Billy Madison.
Yeah, good call.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's their school punk, basically, that just they kind of, you know, play on that cliche a little bit too much, perhaps, and the movie's not quite good enough. But
Billy Madison plays on a cliche? No.
An Adam Sandler movie, too. That's what's so crazy about it.
What?
All right, well, that's going to wrap it up on this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We want to encourage everybody to check out the site, getyourfilmfix.com. You can go on there. You can read all the articles, reviews. You can check out our 48-hour film project submission, No Tomorrow. You know, you can also listen to all of our podcasts on there. We also encourage people to go to iTunes to rate us. There's also a donate tab on our website, by the way. So if you want to help keep us doing what we're doing, we really appreciate anything that people can help to donate to us. And also, you know, as always, we encourage people to check out the Exterior Films podcast as well. So thank you for listening, everybody.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.